This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.
Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. At the start of the 20th century, in the depths of an ancient Egyptian turquoise mine on the Sinai Peninsula, an archaeologist called Sir Flinders Petrie made an astonishing discovery. Scratched onto rocks, pots and portable items, he found scribblings of a very unexpected but strangely familiar nature. He had expected to see the complex pictorial hieroglyphic script of the Egyptian establishment, which had used it for 1,000 years. But it seemed that at this very early period, 1700 BC, the mine workers and Semitic slaves had started using a new informal system of graffiti, one which was brilliantly simple, endlessly adaptable and perfectly portable, the alphabet. This was probably the earliest example of an alphabetic script, and it bears an uncanny resemblance to our own. Did the alphabet spring into life almost fully formed? How did it manage to conquer three-quarters of the globe? And despite its Cyrillic and Arabic variations and the myriad languages it has been used to write, why is there essentially only one alphabet anywhere in the world? With me to discuss the origin of the alphabet is Eleanor Robson, historian of ancient Iraq and fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, Rosalind Thomas, professor of Greek history at Royal Holloway, University of London, and Alan Millard, Rankin Professor Emeritus of Hebrew and Ancient Semitic Languages at the University of Liverpool. Eleanor Robson, the alphabet developed in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean. Can you give us a sense of the scripts that dominated the region before the alphabet as we know it began?
There were two very important scripts, hieroglyphics that many people know about, and cuneiform writing or wedge-shaped writing, which was centred on ancient Iraq. Now, although they look very different, hieroglyphs are basically very pictorial. We all think of pictures of the little birds and the men with their arms in the air. And cuneiform looks like random scratches on the surface of clay, but in fact, structurally, they're very similar. They have a central core of syllabic signs, that is, signs that represent syllables like ma or of or pot, and there are signs that represent whole words or ideas that we can call logograms, and they also have signs which signal what sort of word comes next. So next word is something made of wood, or the next word means a sort of person. So they're very complicated. They have several hundred different visual signs in their repertoire, and so they are very restricted to professional writers.
Right, well, that's a very good summary, and I'd like to go into it a little bit more detail, taking them one at a time. The cuneiform writing, how long had it been in existence, who was using it, and can we just go through it a little bit again?
The earliest evidence we have for writing in the south of Iraq is from the very late 4th millennium BC, so about 3,200.
This is cuneiform.
This is cuneiform.
This is
writing.
On clay.
This
is wedged, right.
The very first writing we have isn't yet wedge-scraped. It's just scratched onto the surface of clay. And it's used by accountants working for the temples in the big cities to write down the things that the temples needed to manage, their labourers, their land, their animals, the goods that their labour has made.
So the capitalists are never going to get a better press as long as they live, if they have something to do with the invention of language.
Absolutely. Well, the invention of writing. I mean, people were speaking for many, many thousands of years before the invention of writing. Yeah. The first writing we have then is simply accountants' tools. It's numbers and concrete nouns, things that can be counted, and that's it for Mesopotamia, for southern Iraq. Similarly in Egypt, about the same time, it's difficult to date exactly when, whether Egyptian hieroglyphs or Mesopotamian cuneiform, which predates the other, they're more or less the same time. The earliest writing in Egypt is similarly numbers and concrete objects, but this time they're found in the tombs of kings, and they're little ivory labels recording the grave goods that were in those tombs. And often the grave goods don't survive, but we have the labels.
So we're not talking about... I stumbled a paragraph or so ago so that people are absolutely clear. We're not talking about language, we're talking about the signs of language. Language had been spoken for many, many thousands, tens of thousands of years. But here we're talking about the writing of it down, which is what we're talking about here.
Yes, but what's even more interesting is this early writing isn't even language-specific because they're representing numbers and whole words, and you could read them almost in any language, and it's difficult because there are no indicators of the sounds of these words. So one could read them in almost any language, and it's only later that the representation of sounds come into writing, perhaps a few hundred years after that.
So the Babylonian cuneiform is telling us about numbers, and it's a trading language. And the Egyptian hieroglyphic is doing more than that, isn't it?
It is very, very quickly becomes more than that. But the very first writing is simply recording ownership. And then it becomes... able to record particularly the deeds of kings. It becomes a display language for showing off about the great feats of royalty.
Alan Millard, can you take us more deeply into the hieroglyphs? Everybody listening will have an idea of the picture language of the
Yes,
of the Egyptians.
I think what happened was that people drew the pictures, but there were various things they wanted to represent which could not be shown easily by pictures. I use a simple English example. If you draw a picture of a thin man and a king, you can read the king is a thin man or the thin man is king. But if you simply take the sounds, you can produce the idea thinking, which is difficult to draw as a picture. And that's what happened both in Babylonia and in Egypt. It's what we call the rebus principle. You draw the thing and you make it stand for the idea. And
did
once you've done
that... Did they do a thin man and a king?
No, that's an example from English, just to make
it
clear.
It's a cracker, isn't it?
But once they did that, they could write almost anything they wanted to, because they had a sound system, a system for representing sounds.
So they had a system for representing sounds. How far could they take this in terms of ideas? I mean, it was very good for saying where the kings were going to go into the next world and the number of goods he was going to take and slaves he was going to take, or she, whatever.
Both in Egypt and Babylonia from 2500 BC onwards, we find almost all the things we would think of writing down being written down. Abstract ideas as well as concrete. Philosophical ideas, religious concepts, ideas about this life and the next life, riddles, we find.
And poetry, literature.
Poetry, certainly, yes.
How many pictures would the Egyptian hieroglyphs have? How many, have you got any idea? We talk about 26 letters of our alphabet, which we're coming to in a few moments, but how many pictures would you have to know as a hieroglyphic scribe?
I think to read hieroglyphs fully, you need to know about 600 signs, and to read Babylonian cuneiform, about 300. Of course, at different periods in the lives, in the histories of those scripts, the numbers of signs would vary. In the early period, there were many more signs, but for economy's sake, the scribes reduced the number. Once they used the signs for their sound values, they didn't need so many pictures of objects because they could spell out, as it were, the sounds of the object.
Mm. And you're saying that it could do everything that can be done in 2003?
Yes. Had they had a space program, they could have written the instructions for the space program.
Really? That's astonishing, isn't it? What limit? So there's no limitations on this then, Rosalind?
Well, I mean, some people have claimed that the alphabet could do all sorts of things which cuneiform and hieroglyphs couldn't because of the exact, when the Greeks created or elaborated on the alphabet from the Phoenicians, then they took it over, because there was an exact, this is the theory, because there's an exact link between the sound and the letter, you can do so much more with it. I don't go along with that, but that has been suggested, that it's just a much more flexible and much more intricate and much cleverer system that can represent absolutely anything that can be said.
One of the things about the Babylonian cuneiform and the Egyptian hieroglyph is they lasted for a very, very long time. Eleni began by talking about in the 4th millennium, say 3200 BC, and they're still flourishing in 1000 BC.
Yes.
That's a very long time. Did they change much over this period? And if not, why not?
As far as I know, they don't change a very great deal over that period. The hieroglyphs particularly are very, very conservative and are virtually the same towards the end of the hieroglyphic period as at the beginning. And as Eleanor said, they start off as labels, but then they develop, and it's an extremely conservative script.
Were the scribes especially taught? Were they socially elite? They were clearly some sort of elite, specially trained. Do we know about how they came to be what they were?
They're very, very complicated training schools, aren't there, for the cuneiform scribes and for the hieroglyphic scribes. Very intense, and that's what's often said about the difference between those and the alphabet. The alphabet is much easier to learn, it's much quicker, and so more people can learn it faster, and it therefore goes further down the social scale.
What do we know about these schools then, Alan?
Oh, we're knowing increasingly, just in the last 5 years, a very interesting study is done on the minutiae of scribal education and the curriculum. So we know that they started off by learning, just like our children do, by making the elements of script, so for the case of Babylonian scribes, the little wedges on the clay, and then to write whole syllables, and then people's names, and then they move on to write lists of words grouped thematically. So the first list of long list of words they learned was the list of trees and wooden objects, terribly boring, and then things made of reed, and then metal, and then stone, etc. And then after a while they learn their numbers and their multiplication tables, etc. And then it's only after a long elementary period that they start to write whole sentences, model legal documents and contracts, and also proverbs, and then begin to write and copy down much longer pieces of literature. And it's all by rote learning. It's copying and listening and memorising and writing again and again until they got it off by heart. So we have their school exercises in hundreds and thousands of copies.
And are we talking about a tiny proportion of people who are literate, able to... can we put a percentage on it? Is it 1%?
I think it's vanishingly small. I mean, A, we're only talking about people who lived in cities. Forget about all the villagers and the nomads. And if we actually look at the archaeology of schoolhouses, they're tiny. They're the size of this room.
Well, we have to explain to our listeners that this is an exceptionally small room.
Exactly.
Twice as big as the table we're sitting at.
And so there's probably only physically room for the teacher and perhaps two or three children in it. And when we look also at the numbers of scribes active in the big institutions, in the temples and palaces, again, we see a very small number. We're talking about probably dozens of people who are literate in any one city.
Alamina, do we find an intellectual elite crossing into a social or political elite?
Yes, the political elite would comprise many people who had learned to write, but as they moved up the ranks, they would not actually write themselves because, like some of us, they would have secretaries to do it for them. So that we find one or two kings who boast of their ability to read and write. And in Egypt, most of the pharaohs were educated and able to read and write, and we find references to them doing that. In Tutankhamun's tomb, there were found some scribal writing implements which had been used with his name on them, and we may assume that he used them as a youngster when he was learning hieroglyphs.
Was there a sense that because this was so exclusive and because it was so difficult, it was important to keep it exclusive and difficult so that it was part of the sort of power pyramid?
There are some indications that the scribes were a closed shop. There are some indications that it went down in families. The scribal business was a family business. But I think if you could pay the teacher, you could learn to be a scribe. That, of course, meant that it was only fairly well-to-do people who could afford to train their children to become scribes.
So we have the hieroglyphics and we have the Babylonian cuneiform, and they're going from, say, 3,200 down to 1,000, but around BC. But around 1800 BC, in your book, The Infancy of the Alphabet, you write how the invention of the alphabet may be imagined, and you picture a Canaanite writer, a Canaanite scribe, working alone in the port of Byblos, and he, you say, and he alone, which is amazing,
invented it. I think he was a scribe who had learnt Egyptian. He may also have been familiar with Babylonian cuneiform, but neither system of writing was very convenient for representing his Canaanite language. Just as, in fact, our alphabet is not very convenient for representing English. If you think about the letters T and H, they stand for the in that, they stand for th in thank you, and they stand for th in anthill. So the Babylonian and Egyptian systems didn't really fit the Canaanite language, and I believe this scribe saw that in Egyptian there were signs which represented simple syllables like ba and da and ga, which were pictures. And what he did was to analyse his language, which was quite a sophisticated feat, to separate out all the principal sounds, the phonemes of his language. And he drew a picture to represent each sound. What he did was what we call the principle of acrophony. He would draw a picture of a door and say, when you see this picture, you don't read it as door, you just read it as duh, with any vowel following. And by that means, he created an alphabet of perhaps 30 signs, each one representing a consonant plus any vowel. Strictly, it's a limited syllabary and not an alphabet at this stage. In his language, no word began with a vowel, so on that principle, he couldn't produce a picture to represent a vowel. And in fact, to write many of the Semitic languages, it's not essential to indicate the vowels. If you look at a modern Arabic or Hebrew newspaper and can read them, you'll find that the vowels are not represented. But because you know the language and the patterns of the language, you know how the vowels will appear. And we see the same today in text messaging.
Yeah, I want to come back. But this is the big invention, isn't it? The alphabet, the phoneme, the idea that you got back to the lowest denominator. Let's come back to whether it was one man, how you know it's one man, why it was Byblos. Let's just leave that right. Because the most important thing is we've had the pictures, we've had the pictures, a picture of water, we've had the syllables, war, ter, and now we have t and r, and they stand for. So if various people, Steven Pinker famously wrote sentences with X's in the middle, but you could read them because of the starting point. Now, it seems to me an extraordinary thing to arrive at. How do you think, Roland, he arrived at it? If it was a he, or not a them, or a her?
Well, I think as Alan says, he was a scribe, probably, who did know Egyptian. But if he was feeling it didn't really fit the language, what does one say about a genius? What does one say about someone who has a brilliant idea? You know, the minute you've invented a paperclip, you can't manage without.
I'd like you to say as much as you can, because how do you think he arrived at this idea that you can use? You go from a picture of water to syllables of water to W.
Well, to some extent, isn't it the case that Egyptian, there is an element in Egyptian already that has an alphabetic principle? They do have these picture signs, they have the signs for meanings, but they also have a few letters which represent a sound. I mean, that's how Champollion actually deciphered the hieroglyphs from the beginning, because of there were certain names like Cleopatra which were written out letter by letter. So that wasn't actually a gigantic leap which this man in Byblos had to make all at once. I mean, there was that element already in Egyptian, wasn't there?
It did exist in Egyptian, but the Egyptians never isolated it from all their other signs. So they never realised that they had an alphabet within their system.
Except perhaps that they used it especially for writing foreign names that couldn't cope, didn't fit very well into the Egyptian phonetic system.
Yes.
So that if you were a scribe outside Egypt and then and having to write in Egyptian, then most of the names you were writing were non-Egyptian names. So perhaps you might be using the single consonant signs rather more than a scribe in Egypt would be.
Can we go back to our man in Canaan before we come back and try to prove whether he lived or not? But certainly something happened then which was remarkable. Just so to explain, to take it even further, because the connections are very close, aren't they? There's a picture of water in Egyptian hieroglyph, which is wavy lines. That's water. We did when we were kids. Wavy water. Now then he finds a word that he finds the word that, well, you take it on from there, and then we get M, which is actually written as wavy water.
Yes.
I'm doing my finger waggling up and down, and
yes,
that, if I stop quickly enough, it's an M, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And that's mu. And then you have the word for, Alan has just mentioned duh for door. Well, in the Canaanite language, that's something like daltu, and that again is duh, and then the ox gives us Aleph, or Alpu, which is the letter A, the guttural sound at the beginning of that word, which eventually turns into A. And for most of the alphabet, we can actually identify the signs. We can see visually which signs that each sound comes from.
So it's almost it's both an abstraction and some atomization, isn't it? Somehow or other, he got to the base of it, and you use a word like resh, and if we print a capital R as a capital now, it can look like a head on a neck, which originally was. So we go picture to syllable to sign, and then this sign, we'll go to this in a minute, later on, this sign becomes fantastically adaptable all around the world. But let's go back to our man in Canaan. Now then, how do you know it was a man? And how do you know he was in Byblos and this is one person?
This is speculation.
Ah, well.
We'll have a bit of speculation. There were female scribes, not very many. We know very little about what was going on in Canaan at this time. But as you said at the beginning, the discovery of some graffiti in the turquoise mines in the Sinai Peninsula give us some of the earliest examples of the alphabet. When they were discovered by Flinders Petrie, he didn't know what they were. The Egyptologist Sir Alan Gardiner recognised in 1915 or thereabouts that they were probably an early form of the alphabet because he could read two or three words on this acrophonic principle that each picture stands only for the initial sound of its name, as W for water might do. Gardiner was able to read one or two words as Semitic Canaanite. Since then, a number of other examples have been found at different sites in the Holy Land, which may be a little earlier than some of these from the Sinai Peninsula, and many which are later, and enable us to trace the development of these signs down to about 1000 BC, when they form what we may call a conventional script, the early alphabet, that we see at Byblos. I think Byblos is a likely place for the invention of the alphabet because it had been a very cosmopolitan port from prehistoric times. The Egyptians fetched cedar wood from the Lebanon through Byblos, and from before 3000 BC we have connections between Byblos and Egypt with Egyptian inscriptions shortly afterwards. It was also the end of a trade route from Babylonia, and we know that there were connections between Babylonia and Byblos at an early date.
But Rosalind Thomas, it was still far away from the two big power centres, the Babylonian and the Egyptian. Was that significant, the fact that it was some distance away?
I think it probably was, because the big power centres have all the vested interests, all the institutions, the scribal schools and so on, which are, as it were, churning out these people very, very skilled in these very complicated systems. And I suppose they wouldn't have any need to move over to this much simpler system. So I don't think it would be a coincidence at all that it was in these areas to the edge of the great power centres where a much simpler system was developed. I mean, they didn't have the structures and so on, which had been working for millennia, couple of millennia anyway. So I think that's very, very likely.
As far as we know, having been discovered there, it kept itself very local for hundreds of years. It stayed in that small area roughly about 1000 BC. Why do you think that was?
If we're thinking about the Greeks and their contact with the Phoenicians and Canaanites.
I'm talking about the first age of Europe, because that came much later.
The absence of sort of contact with the rest of the Mediterranean and the Assyrians, the earlier Babylonian systems wouldn't need to take it over.
It began to go around the Middle East through trade, again through sailors who have brought so many words, including our own language, and the contribution of just, as it were, people bringing words back with the loot that they brought back.
And they started to take the words around. Through people moving as well as objects.
Yes.
And coming back to Rosalind's point, I think also that the Egyptians and the Babylonians had a huge amount invested in their very complicated scripts that went beyond the mere mechanics of how you wrote it, and that it was the language of their gods, for instance. It was the language of their culture. And there was this huge prestige associated with being literate. And that once you started to unpack that and make it more accessible, then in some senses that might be a whole undermining of the structure of authority within Egypt or Babylonia. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is very significant that the alphabet develops on the edge of these big power structures, and that it spreads, although it does spread eventually into Iraq, but through immigration, and that immigrants into the north of Iraq, into Assyria, the Aramaeans take the alphabet in, but it takes the Assyrians... the Assyrians never entirely give up the cuneiform writing system because it has too much prestige for them. It's the language of scholarship and tradition and religion. And the alphabet may be used for mundane things like bureaucracy, but never for the writings of power and control.
Could I come in on that with a modern parallel? The Japanese writing system. The Japanese are very well aware of some of the advantages of the alphabet, and every so often there have been moves to try and make the system slightly simpler and more alphabetic. But in fact, yes, too much is vested in it, and too much Japanese identity is felt to reside in this much more complicated writing system, so they don't change.
Yes, and all we do
works fine.
And although the alphabet is already more adaptable and more flexible and liberating in many ways, we haven't got to that point, because as Alan hinted earlier, you could learn it in the morning where it takes you many years to learn the other things. It's held back for a very long time. Then it does begin to spread about 1000 BC, and a big factor here are the Phoenicians, who great traders, and they begin to take the language right across the Mediterranean, and just as it also goes into the east, into the Persian Empire. But can you say a little about the Phoenicians? Really?
Yes, well, they're fascinating, and they are starting to move out from the west coast of the Levant by about 1000 BC, driven out by the Assyrians, get into Cyprus, then they trade with mainland Greece, Crete, get as far as Sicily and indeed southern Spain. And so they're spreading across the Mediterranean, and at the same time, certain areas of Greece, particularly the Euboeans from the east coast of Greece, are beginning to move eastwards at the end of the so-called Dark Ages. And so we hear, for instance, of Greek pirates or raiders on the Phoenician coast. Some governor writes to an Assyrian king saying, there are these Greeks here again, can I deal with them? So the Greeks are moving east and the Phoenicians are moving west, and there are lots of places where we know from the archaeology that there are Phoenicians resident in areas we think of as Greek, and vice versa. There are certainly Greeks resident on the west coast of Syria by about 800 BC.
Can we stick with the Phoenicians for a moment? Yeah. I mean, how did they develop the alphabet? How did they use it? How did they come across it? I mean, just hold it with them, because they, it were, took it across, let's just say, in rough figures, for 100, even 200 years. They were moving it around more emphatically towards the West.
Yes.
And then it got into the Indo-European languages and came into Latin and eventually to our language and so on.
Mm-hmm. I think they're developing the Canaanite alphabet. Indeed, they are West Canaanite, basically. We call them Phoenicians, but I think they call themselves Canaanites. So they're the same people. And they, as far as I know, they develop it slightly, but they still only have 22 letters. And then the Greeks add these extra letters. They're traders, they're city dwellers as well. Yes.
Well, let's look a little at the history. What happened about 1200 BC was a breakdown of the old state system in the Near East. In Syria, Palestine, there were a lot of city-states, many of them subject to Egypt. About 1200 BC, there were movements of people, especially from the Greek area and Crete into the Near East, which caused the breakdown of the old systems, and they were replaced by what we might call tribal states, Israel, the Arameans in Damascus, and others. And these new states didn't take up the old writing systems of Egypt and Babylonia. Instead, they took up the alphabet for writing their own languages, which were descended from Canaanite, probably. This meant that the alphabet began to spread, and the dead hand of conservative scribes from Babylonia and Egypt was removed. Consequently, when the Phoenicians travelled, they took it with them, and we can imagine Phoenician merchants going to Greece and the Greeks bringing their trading goods and the Phoenicians writing down on wax tablets or on papyrus, Archimedes, three obols, so and so, so many more. And the Greeks looking and saying, what's that? And the Phoenician trader will say, well, that's telling me how much you owe me. And the Greeks said, well, we want to do that too, to make sure you're not cheating us. And so I think they took over the alphabet in that way. But what they did...
Yes? You're all rushing to get to the Greeks, and I'm not yet. We've got plenty of time. And when we get there, the story's nearly done, so we'll just paddle about before then. About 1,000 years ago, is there any sense of these systems in conflict with each other? We still have, despite what Alan's told us about the disruptions and the sort of period of pre-BC, sort of dark ages where in the Middle East, if you want to put it that way, and the breakdowns. But you still have a massive hieroglyphic system in Egypt, which is very influential, a massive cuneiform system, the Babylonian, which is very influential. Their state systems, as Rosalind has pointed out by analogy with the Japanese, it matters very much to keep them and hold them, despite, and so. Is this alphabet a sort of rather insignificant upstart around the edges, still not thought of as being particularly important? Is it still a third language?
Depends who's doing the thinking, I think. If you look at actually what is written on those early alphabetic inscriptions, in fact, some of them are strikingly like those early cuneiform and hieroglyphic inscriptions I was talking about. They're marks of property ownership. The earliest archaeologically attested alphabetic inscriptions are very short, and the sign forms are often irregular, and they haven't quite decided which direction the script ought to go in yet. Sometimes they go left, right, sometimes right, left, sometimes alternating. And so it's only when the Phoenicians come that those sorts of things get standardised and that we get writing going from right to left, the signs of the letters more or less standardised. So that's, I think, the point at which the alphabet becomes a formal state-controlled system, because what you see, perhaps not even state-controlled, but certainly some sort of central control, because you see the standardisation that you expect from a formal education system. So that happens relatively sort of early in the first millennium BC.
It doesn't look like a prestige, high-prestige script, though.
Nor does cuneiform. It depends what writing is for. Mm. Hieroglyphs were for display and for showing off with. Cuneiform was a bureaucrat's tool. The alphabet was a merchant's tool. Yes. Being literacy and numeracy being very closely linked.
That's a very good division into those three, but then we get the alphabet transferring to Greece, which has a far greater need for vowels, and now we have the great vowel insertion in Greece. Can you tell us about... Well, you're now in Greece, Alan, so happiness descends.
I'm not a Greek specialist, that's my colleague's business. But the Greek language can't be written without some marks to indicate vowels. The Greek word for no is ou, and you can't write that unless you have a sign for vowels. So what the Greeks did very quickly was to take some of the signs of the Phoenician alphabet, which marked sounds which were not used in Greek, and use them to mark the vowels that were needed for Greek. So, for example, the first letter of the alphabet, alpha, the Semitic aleph, alpu, as Eleanor has said, a picture of an ox's head, indicates the noise a Cockney makes when he says bottle, a sort of push in the back of the throat. The Greeks don't have that noise, so they took that sign and used it for the sound a. The ox's head is our capital letter A, turned upside down. If you turn the letter upside down, you'll see the two horns sticking up. And that was originally the picture of the ox's head. And the Greeks did that with several sounds, several signs for sounds they didn't use, from Phoenician, producing these vowels, which enabled them to produce what is really the first alphabet, with a sign for each sound. Not a sign for a syllable, ba, ga, di, du, but a sign a, a sign b, and so on. So they could break the words of their language down into basic sounds and represent each one. They had to add a few new letters at the end of the alphabet for sounds which Phoenician didn't have. But basically, that was the alphabet.
When does this start to come into Greek writing? When can we see this happening, Rosalind?
The earliest evidence now is the first half of the 8th century. Various people have been hoping for it to appear earlier, but it doesn't happen. And since Greek is written on bits of old pottery, broken bits of pottery, these survive forever. So the fact that we haven't found any earlier bits of Greek alphabet before the second quarter of the 8th century is making it pretty clear that that's something happened about then. These first graffiti are sort of informal bits of writing, are labelling.
Graffiti's getting a use name in this programme as well as accountancy, really.
Yes, graffiti comes in. It's a technical term for non-official, non-inscribed writing,
which is
slightly scribbles, basically scribbles and labels and so on.
But I've always thought that Homer was writing or dictating or writing, whichever it is, maybe he was dictating in the 8th century. So it would seem that it gets going very. It gets going quite quickly, and then it gets going as a massively complicated, important literary language, which we, in translation, or if we know Greek, can read very fluently today.
Yes. Well, the indications are going both ways. I mean, some of the earliest graffiti are labels, and sometimes they're quite funny. Sometimes a pot has an inscription on it saying, "I am the cup of so-and-so. I am the cup of Korakos," where the object actually speaks in the first person. Lots and lots of proper names are written down very early on. But as you say, I mean, Homer probably was written down pretty early on. It's hard to imagine how they could write this long epic out when they're still learning the alphabet. But one of the most interesting of the early graffiti is actually a piece of writing on a pot found in the island of Pithecusae, which is modern Ischia in the Bay of Naples, probably about 740 BC, which says, "I am the pot of Nestor, I'm the lovely pot of Nestor, and whoever drinks from this will feel the desires of sweet Aphrodite." So, and that's incredibly early, and already you've got a reference to Homer, because the cup of Nestor comes in Homer. It's in hexameter, so you've got the use of writing for verse. And it also seems to be a sort of parody or a joke of the common curse form. Whoever does this shall be damned forever. This instead reverts that and says whoever drinks from this shall feel the desire of love. So that, it is extraordinary that, you know, it's one of the earliest pieces of graffiti. It has all this going on just in it, and it's writing out poetry.
How do you account for this great surge of energy into literature that we read still, mostly in translation, but we read still now, Helena? Was it the flexibility? Was it the insertion of the vowels? Was it the final falling away? I mean, there will obviously be trade movements and economic undertows, but the alphabet itself, it's coming to us now. It's in Greek, it's got the vowels, it's going to fit language after language after language after language. Was it just the excitement of it?
Well, gosh, that's difficult to say. I mean, literature isn't exclusive to the alphabet. We have the most extensive and beautiful and powerful literatures in hieroglyphs and in cuneiform. So one can't attribute poetic flowering simply to the discovery of the alphabet, but certainly the discovery of literacy.
I mean, I think it could be said here that the oral poet, the oral epic poet, who the many oral poets who lay behind Homer, Homer was the last of them, they saw no need to write down. And maybe you start writing down literature when you feel it's under threat, or you're going to forget it, or a great poet is about to die, and therefore his oral poetry will die with him. I mean, I think it's not inevitable that you start writing literature once you have the alphabet.
I do think that we're denying a sort of massive change that did happen, but I don't much as you three do, but I would reckon that people listening to this programme know a lot more about literature post 700 BC than they do about Egyptian literature and literature written cuneiform. I think we're kind of setting out a sort of politically correct denial here. Mm. And as for the oral thing, I mean, we know a transition. Socrates spoke and asked questions. Plato wrote it down, but he wrote dialogues and said writing was bad for you, it hurt your brain. And his pupil, Aristotle, was a writer and got on with it. And I think then it's been got on with at a completely different level ever since.
But we've known about Greek literature for many, many hundreds of years. Sumerian literature has only been deciphered in the last 50. So it's a matter of the Western modern world's ignorance of these ancient literatures, not a question of their intrinsic value or otherwise, I would argue.
It's the prestige of Greek literature, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That it did things that...
Well, don't some things deserve prestige?
Yes.
Certainly. Some of the Egyptian, Babylonian and Sumerian compositions have that prestige, but our education system doesn't introduce them to children. So we only come to them later in life.
You think we've got the sort of same possibilities? That would be wonderful if it's poets, playwrights, thinkers in Sumerian, and they're just waiting there to be found.
Absolutely. Well, some of us know them already and are gradually introducing them to the rest of the world.
Are the programmes beckoning?
I hope so.
Well, can you give us an example then?
Perhaps listeners will have heard of the hero Gilgamesh, and the Epic of Gilgamesh is one of the most beautiful and powerful epics describing the search for immortality, and it's about love, friendship, loss, death, and memory, and is known in various varieties of cuneiform from the early 2nd millennium BC right through to the end of cuneiform writing at the turn of the 1st millennium of the Common Era, and then is transformed in other ways into other literatures as well.
Alan, finally, can I ask you, it seems as if the alphabet's only been invented once, a bit like the wheel. Why do you think that is?
Yes, I think that's true. As we've already said, it was a stroke of genius. And once it was invented, there was really no need to reinvent it. It spread across the world. It went with the Phoenicians westwards to Greece. It went with the Arameans, as Eleanor said, to Iraq. And further east still, so that some of the Indian scripts are based on the Aramaic alphabet, which is a descendant of the original alphabet. Every alphabet in the world is actually descended from that one original, or is an imitation of it. We find a very early imitation at a place in Syria called Ugarit, about 1300 BC, where scribes trained in Babylonian cuneiform took up the idea of the alphabet and made a cuneiform alphabet.
And now we have two-thirds of the world's languages in that alphabet. Do you see anything preventing the rest of the world joining in, though? You were talking about elitists in Japan.
I think it helps that the Romans conquered a very great deal of the remains of the illiterate west of Europe, and then that alphabet was taken over by the colonial powers, who then developed their rule in other parts of the world. I mean, that's surely got to be added in as a big political reason why the alphabet's covered a large part of the world.
But we're back on the old colonialism, we failed to mention its intrinsic values of being atomised and this brilliant invention of the phonemes and so on.
It's learned very fast.
It's learned very fast.
Got to go now. Very sorry. We'll have to come back to it, particularly to those Sumerian stuff. Thank you very much for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.